President-elect Biden's inauguration is only 2 weeks away. And once again, President Trump has found himself in the hot seat thanks to a leaked phone call. Over the weekend, the president called Georgia Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and pressured him to find enough votes to reverse the presidential election results.
You should want to have an accurate election. And you're a Republican.
We believe that we do have an accurate election.
No, I know you don't. You don't have. Not even close. You're off by hundreds of thousands of votes.
When the call was released on Sunday, many reacted with outrage, but others shrugged. What does that call mean? And could it have legal implications for the president and his administration? Let's put your questions to the experts. Here with us is Anthony Michael Kreiss, assistant professor of law at Georgia State University. Michael, welcome to the Anthony, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Mary McCord. She's a visiting professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. She's also a former official rather, at the Justice Department. Mary, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
And what do you want to know? Send us your questions about how this instantly infamous call may or may not jibe with state and federal law. You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. So I quickly just want to get both of your reactions. When you heard the phone call, what were your initial impressions? Anthony?
I was totally shocked. This president has done a lot of things which I think have been quite egregious in terms of attacking democracy, attacking the rule of law. But to hear him on recording, basically browbeating our Secretary of State here in Georgia was really quite shocking.
Mary, what about for you?
Well, I had a similar reaction. I mean, it was a very blatant attempt to undermine the will of the voters in Georgia and to really attack our very democracy. And of course, I initially started thinking, because I spent almost 25 years as a prosecutor, about the fact that, wow, that sounds like, you know, if I were still a prosecutor and I got a tape like that, I would start investigating and looking into it. But I think even more important than that is exactly what Anthony just mentioned, this very type of pressure campaign that was in, you know, living color for a full hour and 2 minutes on that phone call is pretty staggering to come from the president of the United States.
Well, at a rally Monday in Georgia, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris had this to say about the call.
Have y'all heard about that recorded conversation? Well, it was, yes, certainly the voice of desperation. Most certainly that. And it was a bald, bald-faced, bold abuse of power by the President of the United States.
Mary, what qualifies as an abuse of power legally?
Well, abuse of power itself is not sort of a definition of a crime. Certainly, abuse of power can be a basis for impeachment, like we saw a year ago, and certainly various aspects of abuse of power might qualify as criminal under certain criminal statutes. But I think what we're talking about here is we're really talking about, at least there's a predicate there to suggest that he was really trying to coerce the Secretary of State of Georgia into either discounting and getting rid of validly and legally cast votes in order to create a win for him in Georgia, or to actually tabulate fictitious votes in order to create a win. You heard him say, I just need you to find 11,780 votes, one more than I need. And he said that repeatedly. And so that's, you know, given the fact that he's the president, this isn't just the Secretary of State of Georgia getting a phone call from, you know, a constituent who says, I think Trump won and you need to find those votes, or even, another official within Georgia. This is the president of the United States using his power to try to coerce.
Does the Constitution have anything to say about abuse of power in the presidency?
Well, I mean, certainly the Constitution, you know, has all kinds of core fundamental principles, including the separation of powers in the federal government and federalism principles, but it also, you know, which is the essentially the separation of powers between the federal government and the state governments. And the Constitution, by its terms, gives to states the authority to run their own elections, including for federal office. And that's something, you know, we've talked about repeatedly during this election season, many people and many commenters. And of course, what we're seeing today on Capitol Hill with the joint session of Congress to read the votes that have been submitted by the states through their own electoral colleges. And it is an example of those states having followed their processes, submitting those votes, and they'll now be read in a joint session and hopefully confirmed today without any real serious distraction. So there's a lot of places that the Constitution very clearly delegates powers to different branches and between the state and federal government. And these are all things that Trump really has sought to undermine, not only in his call with Raffensperger, but in the pressure he's been putting on Vice President Pence, as you were just talking about earlier in this segment, and pressure he's put on, others to falsify the Electoral College votes.
We're answering your legal questions about the Trump phone call with Georgia Secretary of State Raffensperger. Here with us, Anthony Michael Kreiss of Georgia State University and Mary McCord with Georgetown. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. Let's get back to unpacking President Trump's phone call with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. We're here with Anthony Michael Kreiss, Assistant Professor of Law at Georgia State University, and Mary McCord, Visiting Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Center. She's also the former Acting Assistant Attorney General of National Security at the Department of Justice. And let's hear part of an exchange between President Trump and Ryan Germany, that's the General Counsel for the Georgia Secretary of State.
Now, do you think it's possible that they shredded ballots in Fulton County? Because that's what the rumor is. And also that Dominion took out machines. That Dominion is really moving fast to get rid of their machinery. Do you know anything about that? Because that's illegal.
This is Ryan Germany. No, Dominion is not. Moved any machinery out of Fulton County. We're having
Have they moved the inner parts of the machines and replaced them with other parts?
No.
You sure, Ryan?
I'm sure.
Now, all those assertions have been proven false. But, Anthony, at what point could there be legal ramifications for the president and any of his supporters who are pushing theories that are objectively not true?
Yeah, so under Georgia law, if a person requests, demands, or otherwise attempts to cause another person to engage in election fraud, they're guilty of a crime under Georgia law called solicitation. It's a felony called solicitation to commit election fraud. Under another part of the Georgia code, it is specifically laid out that if the Secretary of State or a member of his office falsifies or destroys official documents, that's election fraud. So we're kind of in that zone of potential criminality here by basically demanding the Secretary of State to add almost 12,000 votes to his totals. I think President Trump essentially asked state officials to usurp the will of Georgians and to overthrow the outcome by false documentation. So as a consequence, there's a plausible argument and a strong one at that, that Donald Trump committed an unlawful act of solicitation to deprive Georgians of a free and fair election. But the key question here is one of intent, because Georgia law also requires that the president knew that he lost the election and had the intent to induce our state officials to commit election fraud. Whether that can be demonstrated is, I think, really up to debate. It's probably worth us getting into some detail later on, but it's also certainly where things, I think, get rather complicated.
Well, I mean, let's get into it a bit now because, you know, Mary, so often we hear this statement, ignorance of the law isn't an excuse, but intent is something a little different. What's your take?
Well, I mean, this is something that, you know, many legal scholars have thought a lot about over the last 4 years, as Trump seems to deal in just, you know, conspiracy theories and falsities and is a prolific tweeter of false statements, and he'll often sort of start them with "people are saying" as a way to I think suggest that they're based in something he's read someplace and give him some cover for what otherwise seems to be debunked facts or not facts, debunked theories. So, but Anthony's right that the law, particularly the criminal law, really does require intent for almost all crimes. And so the question when it comes to the president is, how long can he really keep his head in the sand? And because he wants to believe conspiracy theories and he wants to believe an alternate reality or a non-reality, is that enough to shelter him and shield him from ever any proof of intent? I think it's interesting if you actually listen to the entire phone call, which I did. President Trump starts out with a very, very lengthy litany of details that sound very factual. He appears to be reading from something. He's reading a number of different supposed examples of where false votes were counted for Biden, fraudulent votes, either by dead people or votes that were counted three times. He goes over and over, and he has lots of numbers associated with that. And then as the call goes on, he seems much less tethered in that recounting of what he would purport to be facts, and much more just pressuring the Secretary of State to come up with these votes somewhere. And it's interesting because one of the attorneys on the call, Cleta Mitchell, occasionally will try to bring things back to sort of facts and suggest that they just need some more information from the Secretary of State so that they can do their investigation, so they can establish proof. And the president many times brushes her aside, discounts what she has said. Well, Cleta, we don't really need that. We know I won by hundreds of thousands of votes. I just need 11,780. Can't you find those, Secretary of State? So I think there's some revealing things about his intent, even within just this phone call.
We got this message from Karen who asks, why isn't what Trump did in that phone call to Mr. Raffensperger considered treason? Anthony?
Well, I'm very loath to throw the term treason out there because it's generally a term that we reserve for acts that are made in furtherance of an enemy, right? An enemy state, right? So in a state of war. What the president is doing is not treasonous, but what I would say is it's exceedingly dangerous. The president is attacking the very fundamentals of democracy. Georgia has had a tremendous successful election, and a number of them now. And you know, the truth of the matter is the Secretary of State's office has gone out of their way to debunk all of these conspiracy theories. Not only that, but in Georgia, we have tabulated our November results not once, not twice, but three times. At the president's urging, we did a limited signature audit to ensure that mail ballots in Cobb County were secure and not fraudulent. So, you know, we in Georgia and our officials in Georgia have done everything to go out of their way to disprove and debunk these nonsense theories. That again, right, while I would not use the term treason, is nevertheless a full-on assault on democracy, on fair elections, and that is precisely why we need to take this phone call very seriously. It's why we should be debating whether an investigation is worth pursuing or even a potential prosecution, because we cannot let the President of the United States get away with this kind of behavior where he can browbeat state and local officials when he does not get his way in a free and fair electoral process.
Well, Allison tweets, if Trump wasn't saying this as the President of the United States, but as a less important official, could he be held accountable legally? And Mary, I guess the broader question is whether or not there's a different standard for the president.
Well, I think, first of all, the statutes in federal law, and I believe this is the case with respect to Georgia law as well, but Anthony can correct me if I'm wrong about that, is doesn't isn't tethered to who the conspirators are, to deprive people of their constitutional rights, which would be the right to vote and have their votes counted, or to engage in election fraud by in the procuring or casting or tabulation of ballots. And it doesn't, it also isn't necessary for purposes of other potential crimes like extortion, blackmail, etc. But I do think it's an important question here, because I think it really ups the ante when you think about the pressure that a Secretary of State would feel when it is the president making this phone call as opposed to somebody else. But just to be clear, in terms of the law doesn't treat the president different in this circumstance than the law would treat others who are conspiring. So, for example, cases that have been brought under federal laws involving voter fraud and election fraud and conspiracies to deprive voters of their rights oftentimes have not involved public officials like anyone like the president at all, but there have been conspiracies to conjure up fake voter registration forms or fake ballots, or, you know, the things you hear about, like having, you know, using the names of dead people to cast ballots and things like that. And those, of course, can be, that type of conspiracy can be committed by other individuals.
We're talking about the legal ins and outs of President Trump's now infamous call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. With us, Mary McCord, visiting professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center and former acting assistant attorney general of national security at the Department of Justice. Also with us, Anthony Michael Kreis, assistant professor of law at Georgia State University. We got this message from Janelle in Cincinnati, who says, when Trump is out of office, can the Secretary of State or anyone else Trump has defamed and or bullied personally sue him? Anthony?
Well, defamation law, there's a high hurdle for individuals to bring a defamation suit if they're a public official. And that's for good reason, right? We don't want public officials to, you know, who are subject to a lot of public scrutiny and public criticisms, to be able to easily bring defamation claims and the like. So, you know, I think that that's really not in the cards here. What I think is, you know, more important in terms of forward looking is what will happen in Georgia, you know, in terms of investigating this particular instance of potential, election fraud, or, you know, I guess, you know, solicitation of election fraud, or, you know, the kinds of processes that we have in state law to make sure our elections are free, fair, and transparent.
Well, and that's who in Georgia would lead that type of investigation?
So the Secretary of State and the Board of Elections here would have that power, as well. The Fulton County District Attorney would have the ability to investigate alongside with those state entities. So there are a number of different bodies and you know, institutions here in Georgia which could pursue that investigation should they choose to do so.
And Mary, at the federal level?
Well, at the federal level, you know, this would be the FBI and others that would do in the investigation, and that would be supervised by the Department of Justice. Now, obviously, at this point in time, the Department of Justice is an executive agency that reports to President Trump. Now, we've talked many times over the last 4 years about the fact that by virtue of the Constitution, the president certainly can direct his attorney general, or in this case, an acting attorney general, to take certain actions. But historically, it's been very, very important in order to have credibility in the way that the Department of Justice exercises its prosecutorial discretion. It's been very important to have independence from the White House when it comes to making investigation and prosecutorial decisions using, you know, criminal law tools. So one would hope that it would be the Department of Justice and the lawyers at the Department of Justice and at the FBI that would be making decisions about whether to launch an investigation, hopefully free from any interference from the White House. But we know, based on what we've seen over the last 4 years, that this White House and this president doesn't really understand the need for that type of independence, and has certainly in many other occasions tried to exert pressure on his attorney general or others within the Department of Justice to take certain actions. And so I think, you know, the likelihood of investigations being started right now are, you know, I don't really want to put my thumb on the scale of how likely they are, but I also want to make clear that investigations wouldn't necessarily be publicly known. And so we may not know what the Department of Justice is doing or what their investigation
So we only got a couple of minutes left. I want to quickly move through some other points. We got this email from Elizabeth who says, if it is true that Trump broke Georgia law, how could prosecutors take this forward considering the evidence is a phone conversation that was taped without Trump's knowledge? Would that transcript be admissible in court? Anthony?
Well, Georgia's a one-party state. But what, you know, ultimately what would happen is if a prosecution or prosecutor decided that this is worth their time, we would have an investigation, right? These are not split second decisions that are made based on one phone call alone. It's a process that needs to play out to suss out all the relative facts, both inculpatory and exculpatory. And that's only something that'll happen if prosecutors think this is worth their time and their resources. So, you know, I think this is really a political question now. For our law enforcement here in Georgia, this is why we have investigations. This is why we have prosecutorial discretion. This will take time, and if anything is brought, it'll be about the evidence will be more than just this phone call. So there would be much more brought to bear.
And very briefly, you use the term one party state. Just explain that.
So Georgia, you don't need permission to record somebody else. There was some questions earlier when this first broke out of whether this was confidential or some kind of agreement had been broken. But the Secretary of State made very clear that this was not a confidential discussion, nor should it have been, because it was a conversation about public issues, public matters of public concern between elected officials that represent the people of Georgia, both on the federal and the state level. So I think that those concerns are, were misplaced then, and they would be now if brought up again.
Well, we got this tweet from Jeff who says, what are the guest thoughts on self-pardoning, or what I think is the more likely scenario, resigning in the last hours of his presidency and Mike Pence pardoning him? And we should be clear here, Mary, there are no charges at this point. But your response to Jeff's tweet?
Well, one thing to be clear is, even if there was, self-pardon, I think is very much up in the air whether that's lawful or constitutional. Certainly, if the president were to resign, the vice president, Pence, as the president for the portion of time of the resignation before January 20th, would have that power. And we saw that back when Nixon resigned and Gerald Ford pardoned him. But to be clear, a pardon, a federal pardon, is only for federal crimes. And so that would not apply to any state law crimes, including the ones we've been talking about in Georgia.
We've been talking to Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. She's also visiting professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, and she's the former acting assistant attorney general of national security at the Department of Justice. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jen.
Also with us, Anthony Michael Kreis, assistant professor of law at Georgia State University. Mike, Anthony, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Remember, you can follow us on Instagram. We're at The 1A Show. Today's producers were Katie Klein and Amanda Williams, and thanks for all of your great questions and comments. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.